classrooms and halls had two-tone paint based on some theory that was current about what was good for eyesight. A pale bile green above a nose-high watermark with a darker cheese mold green below. The school is filling up with water, right to the watermark level. Miss Burbage's big wooden desk and chair are floating away, and Miss Burbage with them. We have to tread water or we'll drown. Get back in your seat, says Miss Burbage. Our school is indeed a fortress. Other kids from other schools are attacking it. We rain Miss Burbage's potted African violets down upon their heads. They break through the girls' entrance with a teeter-totter battering ram. We fence with wooden rulers. They throw blackboard erasers. Our only hope is to retreat to the auditorium and barricade the stage with cardboard straw, cardboard twigs, and cardboard bricks from the first great's performance of Three Little Pigs. Get back in your seat, says Miss Burbage. My desk is a helicopter. Mary Ritter sits in front of me, her dual braids spin. Woof, woof, woof. Jack Girton sits behind me, a round boy, a tail rotor. I have twin 50-caliber number 2 pencils. Oh, no! Ack-ack at 12 o'clock high! Good thing I've got a parachute in my book bag. For the last time, says Miss Burbage, get back in your seat. And every couple of months, we'd have a real air raid drill and get under our desks to protect ourselves from nuclear holocaust. Nowadays, the kids, their minds made literal by drug-induced obsession with doing long division, would be scared they were going to die. But we, in the sure and certain hope of fantasy life, knew that atomic bombs only killed grown-ups and probably caused school to be let out early. Billy and I and Johnny and Steve and Bobby and Jerry would survive, like in Lord of the Flies, but without the flies. Not that I had read the book or heard of it, but when I did read it, I was impressed anew with the capacity of adults like William Golding to spoil things. One boy is almost as good as a man. Two boys are half as good as a man. Three boys are useless. New Hampshire saying. 5. Mere anarchy is loosed. Adulthood, however, pursues the most evasive child, and he stumbles upon such trip-ups as the facts of life. These were put in my way by Cousin Stuart on a visit from Chillicothe. Stuart was a forthright and plain-minded sixth grader, not known to tease or fib. I had previously imagined, with the help of parental vagueness, something like a bacterial infection communicated by love and marriage. Mom's tummy got a germ, which was in the air, from Dad. Stuart told me what part of Dad went where in Mom, or approximately where. I was an unbeliever, firm in my sexual atheism. Stuart protested, "It's true." Then he added, more sympathetically, "You'll get used to the idea." He said, "Eventually, you'll even want to do it yourself, with your wife." Although he didn't sound fully convinced about this last part. I was puzzled by the mechanics of the thing. How did this limp member get stuffed into that appointed place? A prescient concern, but I was getting ahead of myself by half a century. I had erections at the time, but I didn't connect them with sex. They seemed to be some pleasurable version of an injury causing stiffness and swelling. I worried a bit about erections. We had a leg-humping toy fox terrier called Pee-wee with a penis that was rigid and ready two-thirds of the day. I asked my mother what was wrong with Pee-wee. "He's nervous," she said. Then I worried a bit about what was making me nervous. It wasn't the facts of life themselves, although these did present a conundrum. Mothers and fathers performed the business to produce a baby. My sisters were twins. Had my parents done it twice? Or had they done it three times. Such questions were not cleared up by the sex education of the day, of which there was none. Looking into contemporary sources such as the supposed Bible of 1950s Parenting, Baby and Child Care by Dr. Benjamin Spock, I see a call for giving children frank and factual information about sexual matters. Women's magazines, newspaper advice columnists, teachers, and parents seem to agree. They also seemed to agree not to listen to themselves. Thus, for boys at least, Dad took us aside and mumbled, "Boys and girls are different, and your mom and I are the same. That is, I mean, we're different too." And after that, he pretty much ground to a halt. There was a long pause. Then he blurted, "Is there anything you want me to tell you?" To which we answered, "No." This, translated from boy speak, meant, "Oh, God, no, 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 please shut up." Mothers must have had more substantial conversations with daughters, if for no other reason than that the girls would be bleeding from a surprising place every month. Or perhaps moms were no better than dads. My high school girlfriend told me she learned all she knew about menstruation from the back of her mother's Kotex box. At any rate, the details of screwing were obscure. The dirty word itself was confusing. I don't know what the girls were saying to each other, but the boys were engaged in various debates. There was, for example, the "how many holes" argument. This was conducted atop Steve Penske's backyard swing set, which had been relegated to a place to climb up and perch on because we considered ourselves too mature to use the swings. The debates were brief and half-hearted. Sex was disgusting, but not disgusting enough to pique a boy's full interest. A sale cat was really disgusting. Sometimes in hot weather, on a busy road, a cat would be hit by a car and repeatedly run over until it was flattened and baked dry on the asphalt. Then the cat could be peeled up and sailed through the air. Toward the end of the 1950s, the Wham-O company began marketing the Frisbee, or Pluto Platter, as it was originally called. The patent holder, Walter Morrison, claimed he got the idea from pie tins he used to toss around on the beach in the 1930s. Any experienced boy could have debunked that story. Since sex and the Frisbee would become totems of the baby boom, there must be some connection. I can only say that the whole use and entire purpose of the sale cat was to toss it at girls. Nowadays, the first glimmerings of puberty lead to the behavior for which puberty was naturally and organically designed. This is a cause of shock and horror to modern parents who are otherwise worshipful of all things natural and organic. Or, so I gather from the media, my wife and children are tactfully mum on the subject. Back then, the first glimmerings of puberty led to mayhem among boys, the sale cat being just the beginning. I suppose this was sublimation. Sublimation doesn't exist anymore, or so I gather from the media, but it was still extant in the 1950s when we channeled forbidden sexual impulses into acceptable activities. The activity we accepted with the most enthusiasm involved another product from the Wham-O company, its slingshot. A good slingshot, loaded with a half-inch steel ball bearing, was, at close range, potentially as lethal and probably as accurate as a 9mm Glock. And every boy was licensed to carry. In fairness, it should be said that it never occurred to us to use our slingshots to settle personal grudges, let alone rob drugstores. And half-inch steel ball bearings were hard to come by and heavy in the pocket. Our usual ammunition was the cat's eyes, mibs, and Cleary's leftover from our marbles playing days. And we only shot at each other for fun. A particularly good game on summer nights was for one of us to crouch in my backyard while the other boys, with their slingshots, were stationed four doors down on the second-floor airing deck above the Stumpf's back door. The solitary hero had to climb over our chain-link fence, belly-crawl through a weed-strewn empty lot, do a broken field run across the open space behind the Inwood and McKay houses with only Johnny's aging German Shepherd for cover, then make his way over the hedges and through the elaborate gardening of the crabby old people who lived next door to the Stumpfs. The old people must have had 100 rose bushes. Fortunately, wearing shorts was unthinkable for any boy over 8. Meanwhile, the airing deck defenders kept up a continual barrage, and their attacker returned fire as best he could until he reached the protective overhang at the Stumpfs' back steps. His last act of bravado was to step out from under this revetment and loose a Parthian shot, which broke a window, and we all caught hell. Breaking a window was a great taboo for the armed boy. According to modern adult lore, the constant scold of our childhood was, "You'll put somebody's eye out!" I don't recall parents ever saying so. They were too worried about us breaking windows. And rightly. Windows seemed to break more easily in those days. Every ball sport was accompanied by the sound of shattering glass. I even managed it while pretending to play football. I was in our upstairs hall, kicking the winning extra point against Notre Dame after the fourth quarter and seconds to go Ohio State touchdown. My shoe came off and went through the window at the top of the stairs. The window situation got worse as boys advanced in their projectile capabilities. We had slingshots and BB guns and artillery of our own invention, such as the firecracker-powered frozen juice can, and the discovery that a Louisville slugger could send a half-inch steel ball bearing about a mile. The boys from one block over were more enterprising. They took expended metal CO2 cartridges, the kind used in seltzer bottles, and packed them with match heads. Then they found a length of pipe with a suitable diameter and crimped one end. The result was a spectacular little rocket launch with a charred CO2 cartridge re-entering the Earth's atmosphere 2 or 3 neighborhoods away, where it doubtless broke a window. The 12-year-olds buying 400 or 500 books of paper matches at the local cigar store were regarded with equanimity by its owner. One young man went too far, however, and broke open a couple of his dad's shotgun shells and replaced the match heads with gunpowder. He was treated in the emergency room. We all knew the place, and I believe he had to go without TV for a week. If someone had asked us, and no one did, why we went everywhere carrying slingshots, BB guns, scout knives, M-80s, and other weaponry, we would have said we were hunting squirrels. This was an acceptable premise. The bowl of human compassion had not yet overflowed and begun to shower its blessings on nature in general, and certainly not on squirrels. It was a crueler age. Concentrating the sun's rays on an anthill with a magnifying glass and watching the ants pop was regarded as a wholesome pastime, like tennis. Our favorite use for tennis rackets was to swat wasps, though not the kind that build big paper hives and have a lot of angry compatriots. We took our tennis rackets to the scruffy lawn of Johnny McKay's cement block church, where sand wasps made their solitary nests between tufts of chickweed. The sand wasp lives down an ominous hole and grows to an immensity, nearly 2 inches in length and thick as a finger. Billy Stumpf, a convincing boy, he grew up to be a boat salesman, claimed its sting was lethal. We would hover as though hung upon a slender thread over the bottomless pit full of fire and wrath and a sand wasp. Then, no doubt, improving our serves and backhands, we'd volley the bug into oblivion. What went on with frogs and fireworks does not bear description. But I have a friend my age who is convinced that when he arrives at the pearly gates, an immense bullfrog will be there, brandishing a huge bottle rocket and staring with grim relish down my friend's throat. We never did get any squirrels. The scampering jerks. They were too hard to hit, even when we resorted to the explosive slingshot team. One boy would grip the slingshot handle in both fists. A second boy would put a cherry bomb in the sling and pull back the elastic to its fullest extent. And a third boy would light the wick. Jerry Harris was a fumbler with matches and slow to yell, "Fire!" I had some explaining to do about the singe holes in my T-shirt. Ruining your clothes was considered grave misbehavior. We had our moral limits. We would never harm a dog. Even the mangiest stray excited our sympathy. We immediately went to our respective kitchens to get something to feed it, causing all our mothers to rush out waving brooms and flapping aprons to chase the poor thing away. It was gospel among mid-century adults that the first thing a dog did when it got lost was catch rabies. And we wouldn't hurt a cat. In the daytime, any cat found out of doors after dark was an enemy to boyhood and sworn prey. We hunted them with our whammos, Daisy air rifles, and firecrackers down alleys, over garbage cans, and between garages. But our incompetence equaled our evil, and I think the most we bagged was an outraged caterwaul. Actually, the cats got the better of us. Having chased a tabby into the 18-inch-wide passageway separating the Stumpf's garage from the Penske's, Johnny McKay let fly with a whole string of lit one-inchers that ricocheted off the eaves, landed at his feet, and left him deaf for a week. Not that his parents noticed, since all the boy ever said to his parents was, "Huh?" We had better luck hunting lawn ornaments. Bird bass, garden gnomes, and glass gazing balls were deemed a challenge to our honor. What kind of timid, weakling boys did people think we were to leave such quarry unguarded in their yards? What sort of clumsy poachers and bad shots did they believe us to be? There's a joyful, ringing clash and a beautiful splay of mirrored shards when a glass gazing ball gets a half-inch steel ball bearing smack in the middle on a moonlit night. People, as well as animals and things, were fair game, as long as they were defenseless. Crabby old people who lived by themselves were tormented. Their doorbells were stuck to a permanent buzzing with thumbtacks. Their windows were soaked, and in the most extreme case I remember, involving the rose-growing Stumpf neighbors, a paper bag full of dog poop was placed on a front porch and set on fire, with the idea that the crabby old people would come out and stamp on the flames. But the dog poop was wet and the blaze died. It was not a good time to be a younger brother, although parents kept that particular torturing somewhat in check by making our backsides fair game, too. It was truly not a good time to be an unusual kid. There was a slight boy at our school, precise in his speech and fastidious in his manners, whose mother had him in a ballet class. His life was hell. Being fat was an offense, unless you were friends with the fat kid. And even then, if Jerry Harris goofed up, it was possible for all of us to turn on him. "Fatty, fatty, 2x4, couldn't get through the outhouse door." We're proud of ourselves as a morally attuned generation for creating a kinder society. More empathetic and caring, more accepting and less judgmental. And it's fair to say we've done so. But we were careful not to become better people until we'd had our fun. When not wreaking havoc on the pets, possessions, or persons of others, we endeavored to wreak it on ourselves. All sports were contact sports. Tackle basketball was the norm beneath the hoop mounted over every garage door. In baseball, it was considered unsporting to steal second without sliding at full speed, cleats first, straight at the second baseman, even if he was nowhere near second base. The point of sandlot football was to knock everybody to the ground. Carrying, throwing, and kicking the football were beside the point. Jerry Harris ran me down. The sedentary nature of childhood obesity had not yet been discovered. Tackled me and broke my arm while I was playing defensive linebacker. We cherished our bicycles as a way to get around, but also, at least as much, as a way to get hurt. A careless dismount could do the job, smacking our testicles against the crossbar. That crossbar marked our bicycle as a boy's bike. There were boys, burdened by older sisters and frugal parents, who rode a girl's bike with a step-through frame. They might as well have been wearing the skirts the step-through frame was designed to accommodate. We rode our bikes down the steepest slopes, not very steep in our part of the Midwest. We rode our bikes around corners at the highest speed, about 10 miles per hour on our single-sprocket Schwinns. Our favorite way to hurt ourselves was playing chicken. Two furiously pedaling boys rode toward each other to see who would swerve. There was, however, a tacit agreement between us that each had flinched last. Imaginative as we were, we lacked the fictional skill to invent a story for parents explaining how we both managed to wreck our bikes at the same place at the same time. Nonetheless, we considered ourselves daredevils, a term of great approbation. Daredevil was a word to which we might have given some thought, inasmuch as the best place to play chicken was the empty parking lot of Johnny McKay's Fire and Brimstone Church, where the sand wasps made their nests. How we really got hurt was by accident, trying to bring our bikes to abrupt halts on loose gravel. We never understood the physics of this maneuver. I blame Tarzan for our ignorance of physics. The old Johnny Weissmuller movies were on TV almost every Saturday morning. Tarzan swung effortlessly on his jungle vine pendulum from wherever he was to wherever he wanted to go, with no thought of pivot point, length of pendulum arc, or pendulum acceleration back to equilibrium position. We would do the same on a rope from a tree branch in the Penske backyard to the roof of the Penske garage, making the Tarzan yodel and trying to thump ourselves on the chest with one hand while holding onto the rope with both. Pendulum acceleration back to equilibrium position was smack into the Penske tree trunk. But whatever ignorance of physics we indulged in, extra glory went to anyone who required a bandage larger than those that came in the standard Band-Aid box. Meanwhile, what were the girls doing? I don't know. Boys didn't notice. Boys didn't notice anything that wasn't loud, fast, or about to explode. The girls were too old to make those high-pitched shrieks of glee or grief that could be heard all over the neighborhood. The raised voices of mothers and daughters didn't carry much beyond bedroom walls, and certainly not all the way back to the alley, where we were skewering newts on lit sparklers. The girls were too young to be fast, as it was still called, and the girls weren't married to us yet, so we didn't make them explode. It used to be that, toward the end of childhood, boys and girls led separate lives. There was a kind of half-joking purdah. On one side of the veil, frilly dress patterns were sewn and stuffed animals were collected. On the other side, Johnny and Bobby and I were given hammers and crowbars and $5 apiece to spend a glorious afternoon tearing down the McKay's rickety one-car garage. We didn't drop the roof right on our heads, but not for lack of trying. Boyhood and girlhood were parodies of manhood and womanhood. As our generation got older, we ceased to be amused by the joke. By the time we'd grown up, the list of things women aren't supposed to do was reduced to using the men's room, unless the line for the women's is really long at sporting events or concerts. And there are only two things men aren't supposed to do, pace up and down in hospital waiting rooms smoking Lucky Strikes while our wives deliver babies and hold forth on what it's like to be a woman. I am not about to violate that second injunction. But the men and women of the baby boom are more alike than men and women used to be. I'm trying to imagine my dad acting like my mom. I'm not having much success, and I'm only slightly better at imagining my mom, pipe stem clenched between her teeth, driving too fast with one eye on the road, trying to dial the car radio to a Cleveland Indians game. The baby boom genders are similar. Therefore, I conclude that the experience of our formative years was similar. The girls were prying up icky things from the busy street of the psyche. They were loading whammos of melodrama with steel ball bearings of emotion. They were lighting firecrackers of hurt feelings, breaking parents' hearts the way we broke parents' windows, and leaving flaming bags of dog poop on the front porch of vulnerable people's sensibilities. And girls were as avid as boys in their attempts to torment a dumb animal, otherwise known as Mom. But, mind you, I was a boy, so I'm only guessing about this. As well as the facts of life, the fact of death obtruded. Of course, if you came from a large Irish family, somebody was always kicking off. There would be a solemnity to the nagging and getting me into my Sunday school clothes and no baseball game on the car radio. Funeral homes shared their architecture with branch banks. Drive-through deposit windows looked like the porte-cochere where the hearse was parked. Why funeral homes were called homes was puzzling, and a strong smell of cut flowers in any kind of home was as surprising then as the smell of boiling cabbage and tobacco smoke would be in a home today. Other than that, the atmosphere, full of grim faces and dull carpet, was reminiscent of a visit to a larger and more populated principal's office. Up at one end was a dimly remembered kin of Dad's, partly scary, partly waxy, and partly covered by the horizontal Dutch door of the casket. A weeping aunt would say, "The good die young." I'd wonder what she was talking about. He was in his 40s. But these deaths were adult matters. Sonny Merton was our age. He lived several blocks away, a sinewy, freckled, and unpleasant boy. He'd grab you by your wrists and yell, "Do you know why they call me Sonny?" and shove your fists into your nose if you didn't say, "Because you're so bright." He rode his bike out into the middle of Central Avenue and was run over by an oil truck. For the next few weeks, we huddled on the school playground every day before the first bell and talked about nothing else. Mostly, we discussed how squashed Sonny had gotten. Several kids claimed to have special knowledge of the accident. "I heard the siren when the ambulance came. My dad talked to somebody who lives right near Central. I saw a oil truck downtown that I bet was the same one." According to the evidence of this testimony, Sonny had gotten very squashed. We all said, "There's no one like Sonny." We all said, "Gosh, that's Sonny." We all said we'd known Sonny well. A few kids, who had, went to his funeral and were objects of envy. They had to use rubber and stuff to make him look human again, but then they wouldn't let us look at his body anyway. It was the most interesting thing that happened all year. And now, when I listen to myself and my friends' rue distant violence among hostile peoples, or possible extinction of man-eating sharks, or thawing ruination of inhospitable Arctic wastelands, I confess that sometimes, not always, but sometimes, I hear an echo of Sonny's name from the school playground. We weren't soft kids. We aren't a soft generation. We couldn't be, or we wouldn't keep getting our own way. And we've been doing so for more than 60 years. Our parents called us soft because we didn't get up at 4 a.m. to help Pa drag a mop through the dust bowl or wear underpants made of barrel staves because Ma couldn't afford burlap, or work two jobs to put ourselves through grade school, or squat in the basement all night with a piece of cheese in our hand because mousetraps were too expensive. We kids were called soft because we didn't go through what our parents went through, which they were usually lying about. And now we call kids soft, their flabby fingers plopping out text messages, bodies barely capable of enough wiggle for wee, mounds of suet, parked in front of LED screens with body mass indexes to make Jerry Harris look like Olga Corbett. I say that, and then I go outside and see kids on skateboards and funny little bicycles and snowboards and twin-tip skis doing things that would have scared the worst word I knew out of me in 1959. There's no such thing as soft kids, at least not in their hard little hearts. I admire the way modern children are trying to break their necks, but I also worry about them. They wear helmets and knee pads and wrist braces. Every post and pole they slam into is padded. The piles of wood chips beneath their slides and swings are as deep as the curbside autumn leaf piles that no one's allowed to burn anymore for fear of harmful air pollution. The rubber mats under their monkey bars are more cushy than what their moms use for yoga. And skate parks, ski hill terrain features, and indoor climbing walls have been built with care to make youthful hijinks harmless. You'll never get to be a splendid generation like the baby boom doing harmless things. Run, kids! Flee! Go ride your boards and bikes down the handicapped access ramps with which every building in America has been so inclusively and sensitively equipped. Nobody's using them, anyway. They're too steep and treacherous to be ascended in a wheelchair, except by Paralympic medalists, and you may become one. Or better yet, get the Uncle Walter that I had. He was not one of those happy-go-lucky younger uncles like Uncle Timmy, whose antics had to be discussed out of children's hearing. Uncle Walter was a respectable uncle, a vice president of something in a corporation, and graying at the temples. We celebrated the 4th of July at his cottage on the lake. The summer after I turned 11, Uncle Walter gave me a grocery bag filled with fireworks of every type and kind. Then he handed me a lit cigarette. Not to smoke, of course. The 1950s were a different time, not a different planet. But because this was considered a sensible way for children to ignite fireworks. Playing with matches was dangerous. I and my like-equipped cousins were turned loose on the beach. 4th of July taught the baby boom an important lesson, albeit one we've frequently ignored. It's a given that the stuff of life will blow up in your face. Just try not to set it all off at once. If I could go through it all again, the slender iron rungs of growing up, I would be as young as any. Robert Lowell, Realities. 6. Ends and Means. Then one day childhood was over. Darn it. Youth, of course, would last forever. The infinite prospect of being young stretched to a horizon that no member of the baby boom has reached yet, unless we're dead. But it takes a lot of growing up to stay permanently youthful, so we put away childish things. Or we claimed that someone put away childish things for us. Billy and Bobby Stump were going on a scenic picnic with my family. Such was our region of the Midwest that the limestone outcroppings at the local state park were considered scenery. One particular rock formation also made a credible scale model of Iwo Jima. There was a crag to represent Mount Suribachi, two flat stone shelves for the Japanese airfields, Motoyama No. 1 and Motoyama No. 2, loose gravel mounds where the fierce battle of the meat grinder took place, and a little crevice to use as the cave where General Kurabashi would hold out until the bitter end, and, to our delight, commit harakiri. All around was a sea of grass controlled by the U.S. Navy. Billy and Bobby and I had been there before. The baby boom would become the generation of current events, highly aware, highly informed, highly involved. But like many baby boom characteristics, this was self-generated. It didn't come naturally. If you had asked my young friends and me about the U-2 spy plane flown by Francis Gary Powers being shot down over Russia, or Adolf Eichmann's capture in Argentina, or rioting in the Belgian Congo, we would have regarded them as hazy events of the distant present. But we knew everything about Iwo Jima. I suggested to Billy and Bobby that we bring our cigar boxes full of lead soldiers on the picnic. "No," said Billy, who had attained the dignity of eighth grade. "Our dad says we're too old to play with soldiers." And so was I. Mr. Stump, he of the machine gun noises and the dead Jap money in the attic, carved miniature fighter planes out of balsa wood in his spare time. He built a train layout that consumed the Stump basement, barely leaving Mrs. Stump room to squeeze between the freight yard sidings and the Maytag. 50 years later, it occurs to me that Mr. Stump would have been the last person on earth to tell his sons they were too old to play with soldiers. It was Billy and Bobby who had gotten to the point where they used the train layout mainly for train wrecks involving their sister's dolls, and not so often anymore, even for that. Then there was the day when my new pair of kids didn't fit into the diamond-shaped openings in chain-link fence the way my outgrown pair of kids had. Chain-link fence seemed designed to accommodate children's feet, and childhood was hemmed around with chain-link fence. The neighborhood had a few short spans of pickets or palings or split rails, randomly located for decoration and keeping nothing in or out. When the greatest generation really meant to fence a place, they used chain link. Nice people strung it upside down, with sharp twist-tie points on the ground and smooth, folded ends in the air so kids wouldn't rip themselves to shreds. Less nice people did the opposite. We scrambled up and over regardless. For 12 years, it had been a shame to use a gate, and now my foot was stuck. What if girls were watching? We'd quit not noticing girls. Not that we noticed much. We were blinded by the dazzling thought that, under their clothes, they were naked. So we still didn't know what they were doing. I asked my wife, what were girls doing when they were 13? We were spying on the boys, she said. We'd get together and say, let's go spy on the boys. I was afraid of that, and me, looking like an idiot with my foot stuck in the chain-link fence. Looking like idiots may be why we stopped jumping off airing decks. That, and the fact that our growing weight, meant we had to find and drag home at least 3 discarded mattresses to break the fall. And we were too big to fit down clothes chutes. What if somebody found out about that at school? How Mom had called the fire department to pull on my ankles because I was butt-stuck with my legs flapping above the laundry hamper. Whatever happened to clothes chutes and to those second-floor decks at the back of the house where the dust mop was shaken and the bedclothes were aired? They were once such common features in the Midwest. Modern houses are full of conveniences. Climate control, Wi-Fi, home entertainment centers, indoor gas grills, elliptical exercise machines, and custom-built walk-in wine cellars. But what do you drop the cat down? And where do you heat water balloons from? But I wander from the subject. And because the subject is the coming of age of a large portion of the American public, all of whom have been through that, maybe it's just as well. I'm certainly not going to talk about sexual awakening, especially not my own. The human heart, with all its mystery, wisdom, and inspiration, is worthy of endless exposition. The human penis is another matter. Let's just say that, like childhood, it was hard to let go of. The baby boom faced a difficulty in leaving childhood behind. We had no motive to do so. Our fathers weren't household tyrants. They weren't even home that often. All the domineering patriarch sob stories of the past, from Abraham's insistence on a career path that was all wrong for Isaac, to King Lear's overcompensation for his inability to express affection to Cordelia, could have been resolved by the introduction of golf. And our moms were understanding. They had read Dr. Spock, women's magazines, and newspaper advice columnists. Maybe they couldn't bring themselves to discuss sex in detail, but in general, you couldn't shut them up about the changes young people are going through. My mother took me aside and solemnly informed me, "If you ask a girl to go swimming and she says she doesn't want to, don't insist. Not even if it's a sunny day and she's in her bathing suit and you're right by the water. She may have personal, private reasons for not wanting to." I was baffled, and I remained baffled for several years, until my high school girlfriend, that great reader of information on feminine hygiene product packaging, explained the problem and how it could be fixed with a switch to tampons. Our understanding moms were more useful when we sneered, pouted, had snits, and went around slamming doors. Then Mom would start in on the changes young people are going through, and Dad would go play golf instead of drowning us. We didn't feel cramped by the limited provincial circumstances of our upbringing. We'd get to that. Circumstances seemed okay at the time, and were going to get lots better when we were old enough to drive. Our parents told us they'd given us everything. An obvious untruth, because where was the moped, the .22 rifle, the above-ground backyard pool, and the pony? But they told us so often that we half believed them. We had it good at home. Subsequent generations figured this out, which is why they're 38 and living in their mom's basement. We were eager to move on. It's a phrase we're still fond of using. Even now, when what we're moving on to is assisted living, we wanted to be older, greater children, cooler kids, and we were willing to make the necessary sacrifices. Instead of jumping off airing decks, we went to a flooded quarry where there was a cliff called Suicide. It was as high as a church steeple, or, anyway, as high as a phone pole, and girls could see you, although some of them didn't want to go swimming. I spent most of a junior high summer day nerving myself to jump off Suicide, but I took a wrong lesson in graceful descent from circus trapeze artists leaping into their nets. I held my arms straight out at my sides. Palms, posterior forearms, triceps, and armpits got spanked bright red on the water. I spent the rest of the afternoon flapping my elbows as if playing flying horses, looking like an idiot. We endured private lessons. These were not as ubiquitous as they would become, but the intent to give children advantages and accomplishments was the same. Not that our parents had any idea what advantage we'd gain by having these accomplishments, or how our accomplishments were supposed to be an advantage. Condoleezza Rice would make a great Secretary of State, but can she figure skate and play the piano? Music was the most frequent of the lesson crazes our parents went through. Billy Stump had a trumpet and was very good at getting spit to dribble out of the spit valve, and he could make extraordinary farting noises with the detached mouthpiece. Steve Penske produced haunted house ghost groans on a Hammond organ. Johnny McKay sang in the church choir. He was so embarrassed by his boy soprano that he practiced hymns at home with a voice like the wrong frog being kissed by a princess. Susie Inwood was learning the violin. And Jerry Harris, who lived directly across the street, had taken up drums, with special emphasis on the cymbals. Between the squeal of one instrument and the crash of the other, it was as if our block were having an all-day car wreck. Nobody's parents objected much when we abandoned music lessons. We also abandoned petty vandalism in favor of petty crime. We slipped a comic book inside another comic book and paid the cashier for one comic book instead of two. We pocketed Dad's change from the top of the dresser. We swiped cigarettes from Mom's purse. We rummaged around at the back of the liquor cabinet among the less frequented bottles of things such as chartreuse and took a putrid sip. In these misdemeanors, we were led by Joe Brody, one of those kids who are real trouble that we met playing sports. Joe would go so far as to take the family car when his parents were asleep, but he only took it around the block. Come to think of it, we weren't there and had nothing but Joe's word to go on that he really did this. As a generation, we were always more law-defying than law-breaking. Our parents, with their greater experience of callous authority, were law-evading, especially around April 15th and on the highway. Help Daddy watch for speed traps. When the baby boom was finally apprehended by the police, it happened at protests and demonstrations. We would be arrested as a matter of principle and or drugs. Not that we completely gave up vandalism. To judge by what I hear about the state of politics and the economy and marriage and the family and the flaming bag of dog poop that we left on the front porch of Iraq, we never did. We had just learned how to TP a house. The trick is to be tall and strong enough to throw an unraveling roll of toilet paper all the way over the roof. Prank phone calls weren't immature. Our parents and their friends made prank phone calls at parties, if everybody had had enough to drink. Let's call the NAACP and tell them that knock-knock joke. Who's there? Eisenhower. Eisenhower who? Eisenhower Johnson's. Eating lunch. The greatest generation was not at its best on racial issues. And a receding conscience seemed to us to be a normal part of growing up, unlike a receding hairline. We've spent millions to stem that tide. Our conscience had been slipping away for a while. It was years since any of us had yelled, "I'm telling!" And it would slip further. The baby boom is a moral generation, but not necessarily a conscientious one. A byword of our 20s and 30s was that nothing, not commercial white bread, not refined sugar, was as unhealthy as guilt. And we turned out to be a healthy bunch. We had started with a conscience. When I was just old enough to be allowed to go around the block on my tricycle, I pedaled up the driveway of Mrs. Furstein, who was arty. Behind her garden shed, she had a pile of the kind of rocks brought from the seashore that were considered artistic when arranged in a garden. I climbed the chain-link fence around the shed, boosted a rock over the smooth, folded ends of the fence top, put the rock on the back step of my tricycle, and pedaled up the driveway of Mr. Biedermeier. Then, fulfilling some mission of the imagination that I can't recall, I hid the rock in Mr. Biedermeier's two-car garage behind the boat. I did this twice and was racked by guilt. Bitter self-reproach kept me awake whole halves of hours past my bedtime. One night, I finally got up, went down to the kitchen in my pajamas, faced my mother, and told her everything. Purloined Furstein rocks smuggled to the Biedermeier garage makes no sense, and it must have made even less sense when recounted by a four-year-old. But Mom said the right thing. I'm sure you didn't mean to. And I didn't mean to do all the things I did in the 1960s and 70s either. Nonetheless, we are, as I said, a moral generation. When the little qualms of guilt that we had chewed off at the end of childhood and kept chewing away through youth and early adulthood came back to us at last, they had grown huge. Mrs. Furstein's artistic garden rock is as big as the planet, and we will experience catastrophic species extinction if we don't get it out of the atmospheric concentration of greenhouse gases in Mr. Biedermeier's garage. But my feelings about my first wife are still healthy. Getting finished with childhood wasn't wholly unpleasant. We were on probation from the Garden of Eden, not expelled. We'd eaten only a tiny bit of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and we'd spit out most of it. So our eyes were only half opened. For example, women were only half naked, even with their clothes off, as we found out thanks to Joe Brody's stepfather's subscription to Playboy. The baby boom girls certainly weren't in sorrow bringing forth children, not at 14, not in those days. None of us had gotten as far as under the sweater over the bra, or even spin the bottle. The ground wasn't cursed for our sake, except when we had yard work chores. We didn't eat the herb of the field. Mom had given up trying to make us finish our vegetables. Nor did we, in the sweat of our face, eat bread. We spent our allowance on Peter Paul Mounds bars, fizzies, and Pez candy in plastic novelty dispensers. We had a day pass to get by the cherubims at Eden's Gate, and if we were nimble, we could avoid the flaming sword of adult intervention in our new liberties, new interests, and new friends. I took the bus downtown to the main library. I needed to look up things for my report on America's greatest inventor, who was Henry Ford, or maybe Thomas Edison. Possibly it was Alexander Graham Bell. Those three guys and the Wright brothers had invented everything. I should have written down which one I was supposed to do the report on. I'd look it up in the main library's huge encyclopedia. Should I pick the A volume for America's greatest inventor, or the G volume for greatest inventor, or the I volume for inventor? Or should I get off the bus one stop early and meet Joe Brody at the bowling alley? Steve Penske got his ham radio license. Ham radio was invented by the Wright brothers, I informed him. It took Steve 6 months to learn Morse code. Johnny McKay and I memorized a little for use in classroom desk tapping. You can guess what dit-dit-da-dit, dit-dit-da, da-dit-da-dit, da-dit-da spells. Steve kept his shortwave radio in the attic. The wire antenna was strung along the rafters. We'd watch while the radio tubes warmed up, then Steve would broadcast to the world.
Calling any station, calling any station, calling any station, this is W8QRX.
And sometimes, faintly with a lot of crackling, someone in a distant place such as New Jersey would reply,
W8QRX, this is W2EFZ,
and a conversation would ensue.
W2EFZ, this is W8QRX. Do you read me? Over.
W8QRX, this is W2EFZ. Roger. Do you read me? Over. And so on, in case you thought Twitter was newly moronic. Johnny McKay bred guinea pigs. They eat their young. This does not turn out to be a conversation starter with girls at YMCA dances. I customized plastic model cars. Plastic model cars were not toys like plastic model airplanes. I cleared the plastic model airplanes out of my bedroom in case someday, eventually, I got a girl in there. Building plastic model cars was a design exercise. My design inspiration was futurism, future being when I turned 16. Then I'd have a car. Meanwhile, in 1/24th scale, I worked on the shape and form this car would take. Although when I finally got a car of my own, I did not, in fact, glue an airplane wing to its trunk lid. There was a fad for building model cars. It is claimed that the baby boom youth was a period of great faddishness due to the growing powers of savvy on Madison Avenue and television mass marketing. Coonskin caps, frisbees, hula hoops, Pez dispensers. And this faddishness, in turn, is claimed to signify something about the baby boom. Perhaps faddishness seems a constant in human affairs. Phone booth stuffing. Kilroy was here. Flagpole sitting, mutton chop sideburns. The fad for dying of tuberculosis may have signified something about the Victorian age. Ascribe significance to the hula hoop, you who can. Billy and Bobby Stumpf devoted themselves anew to sports. Both were stars of our junior high football team, though Billy would be demoted to the second-string freshman squad at the immense local high school and relegated to playing loose end or way, way back. Billy and Bobby wore their football uniforms while carrying their football helmets under their arms more often than the demands of games or practices or the duration of football season required. Jerry Harris collected rocks. All boys collect things, and most boys collect most things. Baseball cards, birds' nests, cigar bands, bottle caps, matchbook covers, arrowheads, or pointy stones that might be arrowheads. Once junior high school maturity strikes, a self-respecting boy may continue collecting, but only if his collection is over-organized, obsessed upon, analyzed, and labeled. And he has to hold forth about his collection. That is, a boy who collects baseball cards must be able to make even other boys who collect baseball cards squirm in tedium with numbing details about why Washington Senators third baseman Harmon Killebrew's card from 1959, when he returned to the majors and played in the All-Star game, is a real prize. Jerry Harris wasn't good at holding forth, nor was he much of a geologist. He labeled all the rocks in his rock collection limestone. I collected comic books. Not all of them pilfered. I inherited Susie Inwood's collection when she began dating. The superhero comics were, frankly, dull. Their authors and artists ran afoul of the same problem Billy, Bobby, Johnny, Steve, Jerry, and I had had trying to play Superman. The superheroes were so more powerful than a locomotive, so faster than a speeding bullet, so busy pulling gizmos out of Robin's tights, that they made short work of ordinary miscreants. Preposterous villains had to be created to give the heroes a fair chance to not win. There was a censorious fuss about comic books, started by the psychiatrist Frederick Wortham's 1954 book, Seduction of the Innocent, which maintained that horrible, gory, and violent comic books were bad for us kids. A thoroughly incompetent shrink, Dr. Wortham had not delved into the horrible, gory, violent minds of kids. But he had a point about comic books being bad for us, from Lex Luthor, Mr. Mixia's Piddlelk, Bizarro, the Joker, the Riddler, and the Penguin. The baby boom got the idea that evil is weird and alien. Hannah Arendt's idea that evil is banal is almost as bad, but more banal. Human sins of greed, pride, envy, sloth, and wildly sputtering wrath were better elucidated by Donald Duck in the comic books written and drawn by Carl Barks. At the age I was, I wouldn't have dared to be seen with a Donald Duck comic book, but hidden in my closet, I probably had the complete works. Huey, Dewey, Louie, Gyro, Gearloose, Gladstone, Gander, and Scrooge McDuck in mint condition. If Mom hadn't cleaned out my room after I went to college, I'd be too rich to be writing. Grown men had collections. President Franklin D. Roosevelt famously collected stamps. I, with a stamp collection of my own, thought he'd had an unfair advantage. The White House probably gets a lot of mail. My godfather went through his pocket change every evening looking for Buffalo nickels, Indian head pennies, and the steel 1 cent pieces that were minted during World War II. Uncle Timmy had a collection of miniature liquor bottles that were, amazingly, considering Uncle Timmy, still sealed and full. It was the age of hobbies. Mr. Stumpf was still working on his train layout. This was beginning to cause conflict with his sons. He kept trying to sneak down the basement to install flashing lights at Lionel grade crossings when he was supposed to be drying the dishes. Meanwhile, Billy and Bobby kept trying to sneak down the basement and extract swiped copies of Joe Brody's stepfather's Playboys from concealment under the